This is Only a Game. I'm J.A. Adande. You may know that our first guest is a pretty funny guy.
And now the game where we ask accomplished people to accomplish something they won't think of as an accomplishment.
But you might not know that Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is also a very serious runner.
I don't think anybody's ever looked at me and said, whoa, that guy's a long-distance runner. They might say that guy probably moonlights as a fire plug. Or if that guy was wearing a skirt, he'd look a little bit like a Dalek from Doctor Who. I get that.
Peter Sagal has run 14 marathons, one of which he finished in just 3 hours and 9 minutes. That's a pace of just over 7 minutes per mile. But to get to this point in his running career, Sagal has gone through some dark moments. Only Game's Martin Kessler has this story.
Before we talk about the period in his life when he says he'd sometimes sneak off to the bathroom in the middle of the day to stare at his protruding ribs and hips, when he ran obsessively, when he lost so much weight that his mother took him to the doctor, Peter Sagal wants to make one thing clear.
You need to say this before you have any conversation about men and body image, which is that women have it 1,000 times worse. Women have been subjected to ridiculous standards of beauty that have changed, much I'm sure to their frustration, over centuries. For men, it's more recent.
Peter Sagal started disliking his own body when he was young.
For whatever reason, when you're an adolescent, you start comparing yourself unfavorably to the rest of the world. You start feeling your own insecurities quite vividly. I've never met... I wouldn't trust anybody who was totally happy with himself as a teenager. I kind of had it bad, and there were a lot of things I didn't like about myself, and one of them was that I was a pudgy little kid who was terribly out of shape.
Sagal was born in 1965 and grew up in suburban New Jersey. His father got caught up in the running boom of the 1970s. He'd wake up early to run before work.
I would laugh at him. I would make fun of him. I would say, you went and ran 4 miles, and where'd you get? Now you're just back here. I've been sitting here eating pancakes, and I think I had the better time. Don't you? I was a snarky. I was destined for my job even as a young boy, I think.
But as Sagal entered adolescence and began disliking his body, he started going to his father's bookshelf and pulling down a particular book. It was Jim Fix's The Complete Book of Running.
The cover of the book has perhaps the platonic ideal of a runner's legs in mid-stride.
That runner was author Jim Fix.
One leg flexing off the ground, the other sort of coming up next to it, behind it, striding forward. And the legs are perfect, thin, lean, muscular. In fact, so muscular you can actually pick out almost the tendons and the striations and the muscle. And I remember very vividly taking down that book and looking at that cover, looking at those legs and, you know, looking at my legs, which were sort of were and still are kind of thick and pudgy and you couldn't see, you know, a muscle to be found.
Sagal says he would flip through the book, taking in the pen and ink drawings of very happy-looking people. And when he was 15, Sagal says he made a decision. He realized he couldn't do anything about his acne or his social awkwardness.
But maybe one thing I could do was actually do something about my lack of shape, my lack of fitness, the fact that I was pudgy. So I asked my father if I could go running with him. And much to his credit, given the mockery that I, subjected him to in the prior years, he said yes and invited me to—no, he didn't invite me. He woke me up the next morning and took me out for a run. And I remember, and I put on my Keds. I remember they were Keds because that's the brand we all had back in the 70s. I have this vague memory of them being orange, but I can't assure you that's true. And what imprints on memory is trauma. So I really vividly remember trying to follow my father out our suburban street and then up a mild hill and really just dying. My lungs were on fire. My head was swimming. We got about a half mile. I said, I'm done. I can't do it. And he said, all right, you turn around, go home. And I turned around and I went home very slowly. And that was miserable.
But the next morning, Peter Sagal put back on his orange shoes.
I guess it just bespeaks my level of dissatisfaction with myself that I was willing to get up and endure it again. And of course, because this is, you know, an aspect of running that I think is always true, but especially when you're 15, I improve quite rapidly.
Sagal says that within a couple months, he was literally running circles around his father. He got obsessive about running. Sagal started racking up 6 or 7 miles every single day, and he severely restricted his diet.
I would literally go to the library and read cookbooks. Because I was so hungry, I needed to do something about food, so I would read about it. I remember watching TV and waiting for food commercials to come on so I could look at the bowl of soup or the can of Dinty Moore beef stew or the whatever it was, because that's how hungry I was. It sort of dominated my waking life.
And how much weight did you end up losing?
I lost about 40 pounds.
Sagal's mother became worried. She took him to the doctor.
He was like, yeah, he's getting a little skinny. It's okay. You're running a lot. Seems healthy. No problem. You know, he didn't ask me, like, how much are you eating every day? And he didn't ask me, like, maybe the most important question he could have asked me was, like, do you consider yourself skinny?
What would you have said if your doctor had asked, do you think you're skinny?
I think I would have told him that I still thought of myself as fat. Or maybe I might have said something to the effect of, oh, well, if I ate more, then I'd get fat again, or something like that. Although I was never diagnosed. I think I was anorexic. The attitude was, no, he's not in trouble. Oh, he's getting in shape. Oh, he's becoming athletic. How wonderful. And it doesn't mean I was, you know, suffering any less. I certainly wasn't very happy at the time.
Sagal says he began eating more his senior year of high school. It helped that he started dating someone and eating meals with her. And when he got to college, he was too busy and distracted to obsess about food. His running became sporadic. The weight eventually came back. Years passed. Sagal became a dad, and he started hosting a public radio show that you maybe hear when you forget to change the dial after tuning into Only a Game.
Basically, I just became less active and more sedentary, and one day I went to the doctor's office for some sort of checkup, and he weighed me, and he was like, all right, 200 pounds, okay, 200 pounds, I'm 5'7". That's not good. And I really freaked out. I was like, it was almost as if all of that self-loathing from my high school years came back and like, oh my God, you've become the thing that you most feared.
Sagal started running again. This time, he didn't restrict his diet in a dangerous way, but he wanted to reach a healthier weight.
And then as I reached 40 in 2005, I said to myself, you know, I'm going to turn 40. I guess I should, you know, run a marathon. That's a good thing to do when you turn 40 and you're afraid of dying.
So Sagal started training for the Chicago Marathon. What did your weight colleagues make of the fact that you embarked on this first marathon?
I think they probably endured it. They endured it as sort of a midlife crisis, you know, just sort of this weird thing that I was going and doing. I think the main problem they endured was because I was getting up so early to go running every day, I would sometimes get very sleepy in the middle of the afternoon. And that became a problem. I'd have to be like, Peter, are you all right? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm good. But other than, I mean, they've put up with a lot of grief for me over the years. I think this was one of the easiest things they had to put up with.
Sagal says he had no idea how to train for a marathon. He overdid it, eventually injuring himself. He had to miss a month of training. But on race day, Sagal lined up.
And it was miserable. I had the worst time because, of course, I hadn't adequately trained. And I remember very vividly, there's sort of a dead spot in mile 19 through 21 of the Chicago Marathon because you're running along in a rather desolate area, running alongside the freeway, heading down south toward Comiskey Park. And it's a very lonely place. And I remember just feeling so miserable. And really wanting to quit, but I said to myself, I've run, you know, 19, 20 miles of a marathon. If I ever want to finish a marathon, I'll have to go back and run 20 miles again just to get to this point, so I might as well finish.
Sagal did. And when he crossed the finish line after 4 hours and 3 minutes, a thought crossed his mind.
Much to my amazement, instead of saying to myself, wow, that was great, now I guess I'll go hike in Nepal or something, I said, I wonder if I can do that faster.
Peter Sagal considers this to be a turning point. His motivation changed. Instead of running to exercise or to lose weight, he started running to improve his time.
All of a sudden, you're doing something that is a positive goal rather than a negative goal. Instead of abasing and erasing yourself, you're improving yourself.
A year later, Sagal ran his second marathon. He cut 40 minutes off his time and qualified for Boston.
Doing it wrong is when you're trying to achieve a standard that's external to you. You're trying to be the skinny, fit cover model that you will never be, and you will make yourself insane if you attempt to do it. The healthy way to do it is to start from a position of how can I be the best version of myself that I can be?
I want to talk about your love handles.
Well, I brought them with me, so Good, good.
The
men of my family were born with love handles, and I know this from looking at my father and looking at my brothers. We will always have them.
So you've accepted that
What other choice do I have? I've accepted that I have love handles and that I don't have hair. There's nothing I can do about either.
But while Sehgal has worked on accepting his own body, he sees ways in which society is sending more of the wrong messages to men.
I was watching, because this is one of my enthusiasms, Game of Thrones, and I was watching a scene with Theon Greyjoy.
I'm a Greyjoy. I can't fight for Rob and my father both.
Who's a sniveling character. He is by no means an admirable guy. And yet when he takes off his shirt, he could have been a professional bodybuilder 30 years ago, because that's just the standard now.
Sehgal says back in the 70s, kids' Spider-Man costumes were just plastic smocks with a picture of Spider-Man's torso. Now they come with faux muscles.
It's weird to have an 8 or 9-year-old boy walking around with these fake Arnold Schwarzenegger physique. But there's this insane inflation on, you know, male body image that we're all sort of rolling with, even as we speak.
So maybe it's not so surprising that Sehgal says men are more likely to talk to him about depression and marital problems, other things he's been open about, than about their bodies.
I think it would be a lot easier for guys who have these issues to know that they're, like in a lot of things, they're not entirely alone.
Sehgal is doing his part. He's released his own book about running. And in a nod to Jim Fix's The Complete Book of Running, the book he used to pull off his father's shelf, Sehgal titled it The Incomplete Book of Running. And he put his own legs on the cover.
Because they're not Jim Fix's legs. They never will be. They never could be. But that's the whole point. I mean, in a weird way, you can sort of describe my whole sort of mental and athletic journey from one point to another of wanting to have legs like those, to writing my own book, putting my own legs in the cover and saying, yeah, they're my legs and they're good enough to be in the cover of a book, my book. And that's the whole, I think, difference between trying to be something else and trying to be the best practical version of yourself.
That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sehgal. Our story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. A couple years ago, Bruce Seifert got a letter from the Indiana Football Hall of Fame. It said that he had been nominated for induction.
In my heart, I just felt that they had kind of picked the wrong guy.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
How do we perceive our experience as humans? Who are we today and who could we be tomorrow? I'm Guy Raz. On the TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas that animate our world. Each week, it's the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
I'm J.A. Adande, and it's time for three stories you should know. U.S. Olympic athletes are considering forming a union, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and by Lindsay Gibbs of Think Progress. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here, J.A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Rachel, what's going on?
Well, Jay, U.S. Olympic athletes for years have been frustrated at what they see as a lack of power in decision-making at the U.S. Olympic Committee, and the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal in gymnastics might have been their last straw. The USOC's Athletics Advisory Council, made up of athletes elected by others in their sport, said last weekend they're considered forming a union. They really signaled they're serious about this by who they invited as an advisor, Don Fair, the former MLB Players Association executive director.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. I mean, they mean business, right? And he's not formally retained by them, but he was there to answer questions and I think signaled the seriousness of this consideration.
I'm all for unions. I think they absolutely need more power. Logistically, I think I have a hard time picturing exactly how this works, considering the Olympic movement is, of course, about about so much more than just the athletes that make it to the Olympics. And there's so many sports, but just because it's hard doesn't mean it shouldn't be done and they shouldn't take steps towards getting more power. And if they can figure out a way to actually unionize, I think that could be a whole new world for Olympic athletes.
As you say, the logistics sounds so daunting, right?
Yeah.
When you've got so many different sports, so many different athletes, different seasons, different cycles. How do you get everybody coordinated? And I had the thought that initially you don't want to see these type of things in Olympics, right? That's one thing we like about them. You don't have lockouts or strikes. But we have seen in the past, if you're old enough to remember, boycotts. We've seen, for example, the United States stay home and convince some allies to do the same in 1980 to protest Russia's invasion of Afghanistan. The Eastern Bloc, led by the then Soviet Union, returned the favor in 1984. So if the decisions can be made for the athletes, then why can't the athletes have some agency in their decisions and do what's in their best interest, even if that means some type of labor shutdown when it comes to the Olympics, Rachel?
I think so. And I think you guys make good points about the difficulty they might have in organizing what we understand as a union. But I do think they might end up with some sort of professional representation outside of what they have now. You know, the advisory council has existed for a long time, but, you know, they're all volunteers. They're all athletes. So they're extremely busy. So I think they are realizing if they want to have a meaningful voice, they really need to try something else.
More litigation in sports. Lindsay, what do you have for us?
This past week, a bill was shut down in the South Dakota legislature that would have made sure that transgender youth could only participate in sports based on the gender on their birth certificate, not their gender identity. Activists had said this would essentially ban transgender kids from participating in youth sports. What was noteworthy about this was the words that were used to defend the existence of the bill, which came directly from Martina Navratilova, of course, the LGBT or LGB champion of rights, tennis legend herself. She had written an op-ed in the Sunday Times saying that allowing transgender women in women's sports is cheating. To put the argument at its most basic, a man can decide to be female, take hormones, win everything in sight, and then go back and reverse his decision. Now, Martina said that this was only pertaining to elite athletes and that she did not mean this to be used on the grassroots level, but it's hard to see how she didn't see this coming.
I think first we do need to acknowledge that the world is changing faster than a lot of people are comfortable with, and I think that's why you see reactionary bills like this. But as we know, authority figures have banned people in the past from certain areas or pursuits. And in most cases, we know that's very wrong. And these are cautionary tales. You know, any ban or prohibition has to be backed with science, reason, not scare tactics. And, you know, also with the legislature, how about sending a signal to high school sports not to take things too seriously by taking on issues that really should stay at the local level with coaches or maybe the high school association? I think they just waded in where they shouldn't have.
And speaking of wading in where perhaps they shouldn't have, but to have Martina Navratilova, long considered a champion of gay and lesbian rights in sports and beyond, to have her words used in this situation, I think is surprising and certainly for so many people disappointing. But what it served to me is a reminder that it's hard to compact complicated issues into one convenient moniker. Just because someone such as Martina Navratilova can be such a great champion for the gay and lesbian cause, that doesn't automatically mean she's going to be a great champion for the transgender cause.
Absolutely. And I think the saddest thing is that she was just pushing false narratives. She's pushing this fear-mongering tactic. And it is disappointing. And I hope that she will listen and learn.
Moving over to college basketball, the idea of shutting it down has been in the news recently with regards to Zion Williamson. The Duke star recently suffered a knee injury. A lot of people thought he should just sit out the rest of the season and prepare himself for the NBA draft. And there was a lot of pushback to that. But I noticed that you don't have much of an argument whenever there is a suggestion or the actual forcing to take a redshirt season. You notice why you don't hear much argument? Because this is done to protect the school, right? They get more return on investment. They get another year of eligibility. Why aren't we having more conversations about redshirting itself if people are so put off by the notion of an athlete shutting it down.
One reason we're not having more conversations is because I think at the very highest levels of college sports, redshirting is really on the wane. College football coaches, for instance, many of them are on the three-year plan. They assume that players will not stay 1 minute longer than the three-year minimum they have to before they enter the NFL draft. And so they want to have guys on a schedule to maybe even have a chance to graduate in 3 years because they know they're not going to get recruits if they're going to force them to redshirt in many cases. And I think the same is true in college basketball. You know, the very best players, coaches just accept they're not going to stay longer than a year. And so no college basketball coach in his right mind would force, you know, Zion Williamson to redshirt because he's basically shooting himself in the foot and not benefiting from his services for that year.
You know, you see it similarly used to deal with transfers, right? I see in the women's basketball game all the time, forced to sit out for a year because you transfer schools and they want to discourage these students from transferring. And you're right, it's all about what's in the best interest of the schools. It's probably time to rethink the whole system. Beyond time, actually, I would say.
One idea that might help, but was actually suggested by the athletic director at Florida, who just mused on Twitter one day, what about adding a fifth year of eligibility? Give everyone, well, in particular, high-achieving academic prep athletes, you know, if they do well academically, then as they enter college, they would be granted a fifth year of eligibility potential. So there you have the academic incentive that they say they want, right, for these student athletes. And also that would help mitigate this redshirting issue, right? You wouldn't have to worry about losing 25% of your eligibility if you redshirt a year because you would have that fifth year waiting for you if you'd done well enough in school. I'd like to thank my guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. It's been Lindsay Gibbs of Think Progress, in addition to The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Thank you, Lindsay, and thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jay.
Earlier this week, New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft pleaded not guilty to two misdemeanor counts of soliciting prostitution. Prosecutors alleged that Kraft visited the Orchids of Asia Day Spa in Jupiter, Florida in January. That business allegedly has ties to an international sex trafficking ring. All of this leaves Patriots fans with a dilemma. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
He shows up on Sunday afternoon and lets out a deep sigh. The ticket holder has something on his mind. I have to figure out if we're giving up our season tickets, he says. I'll support whatever you decide, the friend tells the ticket holder, trying to be helpful. The seats are in your name. This group of four has been attending Patriots games together for as long as I've known them. No previous Patriots scandal has created this crisis of conscience. Not Spygate, certainly not Deflategate. But the ticket holder is really troubled this time. If only Kraft had come out and said he was sorry, the ticket holder says hopefully. Said he was still distraught over the death of his wife. Promised the full weight of his charitable foundation would now be dedicated to putting an end to human trafficking. Myra died almost 8 years ago, I say, not being very helpful. The league will suspend him, the friend predicts. They've issued a statement. The personal conduct policy applies. The ticket holder and I are not convinced. Would it change things if none of the women were trafficked? I ask, trying to be helpful. Yes, the ticket holder says. But with a place like that, he had to know. How could he not know that the women are sometimes trafficked in a place like that? Patriots fans aren't alone in asking themselves these questions. When one team picks up the player accused of domestic abuse or another trades for the guy who made homophobic comments, fans notice. Some walk away. But when it's the owner who's accused, it feels bigger somehow, more important. I just have to figure out if we're giving up our season tickets, the ticket holder repeats. I'll support whatever you decide, the friend says. The conversation could go around and around like this forever. How soon do we have to renew? The friend finally asks. Soon, the ticket holder says. But not yet.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given. In 2017, Bruce Seifert found a letter in his mailbox. It was from the Indiana Football Hall of Fame.
It said that I had been nominated to be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Seifert, a football coach from Indianapolis, considered it a huge honor. but something began to bug him.
In my heart, I just felt that they had kind of picked the wrong guy.
He says he thought about that a lot. He even prayed about it, and it became clear what he should do. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Back in the early 80s, Bob Tully was an assistant football coach at Roncalli High, a private Catholic school on the south side of Indianapolis. One day, he made his way to a coaches' meeting.
I walked into the gymnasium and I heard this laughing and giggling.
It was coming from Bruce and another assistant named Ken LaRose.
Throwing each other off of the top of the stage into the wrestling mats. And I made the big mistake of coming in and saying, "What in the world are you guys doing?"
That gave the roughhousing coaches an idea.
I saw Bruce look down and I saw Kenny look down. And the next thing I know, they're jumping down and they're chasing me, catching me and taking me up and throwing me off of the stage into the mats, throwing me around.
Bob Tully is a pretty small guy. The guys tossing him around weren't. They had played for Butler University. Bruce was a 6 foot, 200 pound running back.
He was just an animal. If you ever saw him run the ball for Butler University, you'd know what I meant. He was just an animal. I still have teeth prints on my neck from where Bruce used to grab me and bite me and wrestle me and do those kinds of things.
You actually have teeth marks?
No, I was just kidding you.
Okay, good, good.
But he did bite me a few times.
I think I hadn't had lunch that day, so I was hungry, I guess.
The roughhousing went on for years, but Bruce and Bob's story goes beyond childish antics. In fact, the marks they've made on each other's lives are deep and indelible. When Bob Tully was in high school, he wanted to be an Indiana state trooper.
However, there was a height requirement, and I didn't quite meet it.
The requirement was 5'7". Bob's 5'5". But his stature didn't prevent him from playing football. He earned 4 varsity letters as a running back and 4 more in other sports. He graduated high school in 1960. 2 years later, while still an undergrad at Indiana University, Bob was offered a job at a new high school in Indianapolis called Bishop Chartrand. He took it.
I cleaned bathrooms, I taught a little bit, and I helped coach all sports.
But as far as Bob was concerned, he had moved to Indy for just one reason.
I coached football. That was the main reason that I came up.
Bob juggled his college studies with his new job. He lived on the top floor of the Bishop Chartrand building and made regular trips between Indianapolis and Bloomington.
I loved the experience. My life was a daggone ball of joy at the time. I loved it.
Bob served as Chartrand's assistant football coach until 1969, when the school merged with another to create Roncalli High. He was head coach there from 1970 to 1973, posting a modest record of 21-19. Many credit him with holding the football program together during the difficult merger. Those were Bob's only 4 seasons as head coach. In 1974, he became Roncalli High's athletic director. But he stuck with the football team as an assistant. A few years later, Bruce Seifrus joined him on the coaching staff.
Bob is an amazing guy. He has a booming voice when he's coaching, a huge personality, just a great sense of humor. And he was one of the best football coaches I've ever been around.
But Bruce says Bob's personal interest in students is what distinguished him from most football coaches. He says Bob was always making the school rounds.
To motivate kids and relate to kids, whether it's in the classroom or in the cafeteria during lunchtime or Friday nights during games. So just an awesome guy.
As assistants, Bob and Bruce helped lead Roncalli High School to 2 state championships. Then in 1990, Bruce was promoted to head coach. He leaned on Bob during his rookie moments.
I found myself oftentimes on Friday nights, you know, if it was a 4th-and-1 out at midfield or 3rd-and-4 on the 11-yard line going in, whatever, you know, just asking, "Hey, Bob, you know, what would you do here?" And he'd give suggestions, and they almost always worked.
Bruce was Roncalli High's head football coach for nearly 3 decades. He won 7 state championships, nearly 250 games, and was Coach of the Year 12 times. He retired from coaching in 2016, 6 years after Bob did. On paper, Bruce has the much gaudier resume, but Bruce always attributes his success to what he learned from Bob. So a couple years ago, when Bruce got that letter from the Indiana Football Hall of Fame, he thought about Bob.
Nobody has impacted Ron Colley football the way that Bob Tolley has. With all that he had done for the school and thousands of kids and our coaches, Bob was the mentor for all of us. I just felt like he was the true Hall of Famer.
Bruce contacted the Indiana Football Hall of Fame and declared,
"If it's possible for the two of us to be inducted, then I can't think of a greater honor than that. But if only one could be nominated, I wanted to withdraw my name and nominate Bob and see what needed to be done to move forward with his nomination."
Bruce waited anxiously for 3 weeks. Then the hall responded.
Bob and I both had been selected to be inducted into the hall. You know, this was the best. To be able to be inducted with Bob, I couldn't have imagined anything being more meaningful than that.
Bruce told Bob the good news.
I was at a loss for words. This was a dream of mine, just to be nominated, to have somebody recognize that they thought I was worthy. To have him do that, I don't have the words in my vocabulary to tell you what that means to me.
On August 30, 2018, Bob Tully and Bruce Seifris were inducted together into the Indiana Football Hall of Fame. You have to wonder if, on that occasion, Bruce looked across the stage and, just for old time's sake, thought about throwing Bob off of it.
That's Only Games' Gary Wallach. Bruce Seifris is now executive director of the Catholic Youth Organization for the Indianapolis Archdiocese. Bob Tolley no longer coaches, but he's in his sixth decade at Roncalli High School. In May of 2017, a member of the Quinault Nation in Western Washington State died in a racist incident.
And it was shocking. It was such an emptiness that, you know, just couldn't be filled again.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
President Trump made history the first time he met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Now he's hoping to do it again as the two meet for their second summit.
He's looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. We've made tremendous progress.
Can Trump actually convince Kim to give up his nuclear weapons? Follow all the latest by subscribing to the NPR Politics Podcast.
I'm J.A. Adande. Next week on Only a Game, how the Atlanta Dream's Nikki Collins stepped out of her husband's shadow and won WNBA Coach of the Year honors. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with this week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, J.A.
Charlie, Bryce Harper has signed with the Philadelphia Phillies for a reported $330 million over 13 years. It's the richest free agent deal in the history of team sports. This is a good deal for all involved?
I think so, but wasn't Philadelphia one of the places that Bryce Harper said he didn't want to go?
Until they made out a list, and the list included $300 million or so.
Well, not just that, but his contract doesn't allow him to be traded, and it doesn't allow the team to opt out. So he's going to do the full 13 years of luxurious incarceration with the Phillies.
Yeah, there is a great story by Tom Verducci in Sports Illustrated that kind of detailed all the negotiations that went into this. And according to Harper's agent, Scott Boras, the prime motivation for him was he wanted to be in one place for the duration, for the rest of his career, so to speak, certainly through his prime.
Good for him. I mean, it looks like a deal that would benefit both. I mean, obviously, Philadelphia wants him there for the 13 years. So, you know, when he finally does go into the Hall of Fame, he's going to go in with a Phillies cap, I guess.
Well, Charlie, on Monday night, James Harden's streak of scoring 30 points or more in a game ended at 32. Harden finished with 28 points that night. How did the Atlanta Hawks shut him down?
Well, they shut him down to 28. I mean, but the great thing was he was 2 points away from continuing the streak. Not on our watch, said the Atlanta Hawks. They quadruple teamed him on the last possession. Houston was 8 points ahead. They were going to win anyway. So all he got to do was dribble. He never did get a chance to put one up to continue the streak.
Well, he came back and dropped 58 points in a game against the Miami Heat. So he almost went, okay, you're going to hold me to 30. I'm going to double 30 the next time out. practically.
Yeah, that's terrific. He took out on the Heat what he wanted to do to the Hawks. I don't know if that's fair either. But he's having an MVP season. I mean, he's just been better than terrific.
Charlie, Johnny Manziel wasn't just cut by the Montreal Alouettes this week. He was banned by the entire Canadian Football League. With new football leagues popping up all over the United States, will Manziel get another chance?
I have no idea. I guess maybe if you were dying for a gay attraction, you might give him a try. This is moving towards the tragic. I mean, because clearly he was cut and banned from the CFL for violating the character clauses in his contract. They're not saying what they are, but it's not hard to imagine. He was a real star in college at Texas A&M. I remember seeing him in the Cotton Bowl. He was charismatic. He was talented. And he just got eaten alive by what Joni Mitchell calls the star-making machinery. And, you know, now he's got no place else to go, really.
Charlie, the Buffalo Bills managed to make an appearance in Michael Cohen's congressional testimony this week with an allegation that Donald Trump inflated his net worth in an attempt to buy the NFL team. So what if the Buffalo Bills wind up being the loose thread that unravels the presidency?
You know, I was at the hearings in Washington, and my ears just went straight up to the top of my head when I heard that. Because we've all known for years that Donald Trump wanted to buy into the NFL and that the NFL doesn't want any part of him. It was during the questioning about whether or not he inflated his assets to essentially commit bank fraud and get a loan from Deutsche Bank. And Michael Cohen said he was trying to inflate the value to get a loan to buy the Buffalo Bills. Talk about a franchise that can't buy a break.
Can't win. He's been quoted as saying if he had bought the franchise, then he wouldn't have competed for the presidency. And we wouldn't be using the words President Donald Trump right now. Maybe Colin Kaepernick would have remained employed in the NFL if Donald Trump was a team owner.
Yeah, but you also have to remember that Donald Trump is responsible for an entire league going out of business. So I don't think I think most of any alternate history that doesn't include, you know, severe financial reversals isn't quite believable.
Danielle Gibson is a softball player for the University of Arkansas, and she hit for a cycle last weekend. Some of our listeners will be thinking, so what? Plenty of players do that. But there's an interesting twist to Gibson's accomplishment, right?
She hit the home run cycle. She hit a home run in four consecutive innings, which you can do in softball because of the number of runs that people score. But that is an unprecedented feat, I guess. It's only happened once in professional baseball, and it was done, by the way, for another guy from Arkansas, a guy named Tyrone Horn, in 1998 for the Arkansas Travelers. It's never been done in MLB, and it's only happened once in softball before that. But nobody ever hit the home run cycle in consecutive innings. Danielle, good for you.
I was watching the highlights, and you know, here's a two-run homer and a three-run homer and a grand slam. And that was amazing in its own right. Right.
Right.
And I'm thinking, wow, what an incredible performance. And I'm just kind of thinking, I thought that was the reason that we were seeing the highlight. You know, all those home runs and runs batted in was remarkable enough. And I just kind of thought, well, God, wouldn't it be amazing if she could actually hit for the home run cycle? And then lo and behold, she did it with the solo home run. And the next at bat was absolutely extraordinary.
I was amazed by how extraordinary it was.
And finally, Charlie, while in spring training, New York Mets outfielder Brandon Nimmo suffered an injury, and it's one of the weirder ones we've heard about.
He cooked himself some chicken, didn't quite cook it long enough, and wound up with food poisoning. Guy's 25, though. He should either know how to cook a chicken at this point or know where KFC is.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce from time to time at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us here each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, J.A.
Have you subscribed to the Only a Game podcast yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss an episode. Go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a review. It will help other listeners find our show. The Quinault Reservation is on the edge of Washington State's Olympic Peninsula. It's isolated, and in the winter, it's wet and dark. What knits the community together through the long winters is basketball. So when something terrible happened to one of Quinault's star basketball players, it shook the whole reservation. And before we get started, just a warning that parts of this story are difficult to hear. Please use your discretion. Here's reporter Eilish O'Neill.
In May 2017, Corey Smith was sleeping in a hotel in eastern Washington when the phone woke him up.
2:30 in the morning, there's been an accident. I said, what kind of accident? I said, well, Jimmy and Harvey got ran over.
Jimmy Smith Kramer is Corey's nephew. Harvey is Jimmy's friend. Corey and I met on the beach of the Quinault Reservation, so the sound you hear in the background is the Pacific Ocean. Almost 2 years later, there's a lot we still don't know about what happened that night. But what we do know is this. Jimmy was celebrating his 20th birthday at Donkey Creek, a campsite in the Olympic National Forest. Jimmy's friends, also members of the Quinault Nation, and two white men got in some kind of dispute. The white men were driving a pickup truck. The driver backed over Jimmy and Harvey, put his car in drive, and ran over them again. Bystanders later told Corey that,
you know, he's out there war whooping, saying some racial slurs, you know, calling you like he just ran over an Indian.
All Corey knew at the time was that Jimmy and Harvey were in the hospital in critical condition. So Corey got dressed and started the 5-hour drive back to the reservation.
I didn't expect the worst. You know, Jimmy's a tough kid. He's going to be fine. You know, I kept telling myself that he's going to be fine. He'll pull through this.
Jimmy's mom died when he was only 4 years old. So Corey and his girlfriend took Jimmy in and raised him as their own son. One of the things Corey taught Jimmy was how to play basketball.
Since he could walk, he's just played basketball. I'd take him to 8-and-under tournaments, and he stood out, you know, like worked hard, and he really took pride in playing defense.
When Jimmy was in middle school, the captain of the high school basketball team took him under his wing.
Jimmy's a fifth-grade kid, sixth-grade kid, and there's a senior in high school. He'd come pick him up every night. You know, Jimmy, you ready? Let's go play basketball. Jim's eyes would light up. As a young kid, having an older kid, a star of the basketball team, come to your house and pick you up. You know, I don't think he realizes what he'd done for Jimmy.
Basketball is really important on the Quinault Reservation. Corey says it feels like everyone goes to the high school games.
They'll bring their, you know, big pots of chili. They'll have their Indian tacos, you know. It's just a good time. You know, I'm going to go watch basketball and I'm going to eat dinner at the same time.
The town of Tohola is the seat of the Quinault tribe. It borders the Pacific Ocean on one side and woods on the other three sides. The whole town is about 5 blocks by 5 blocks. The one gas station is also the one grocery store and also the only little cafe with some fast food and a couple of tables.
There ain't no malls around here. There ain't no movies around here, bowling alleys. There's none of that around here. These kids turn to picking up a remote control and playing Fortnite all night long or something, you know, playing video games all night. And some kids, they might turn to drugs or alcohol.
When I first moved here, I was bored.
Tyler Crossguns grew up on the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana and moved to the Quinault Reservation back in 2015.
I was walking around one day through the town of Tohola and looking for something to do, and all I could hear is basketballs dribbling every block. And started nosing around, walking all over, and I ran into a group of kids playing basketball.
Tyler joined in, and pretty soon he was playing basketball every day.
If I didn't have a basketball when I got here, I don't think I would have stayed.
Tyler Crossguns became the high school basketball coach last year. But back in 2015, Tyler was the new kid in town, and Jimmy was the star of the high school basketball team.
I was pretty athletic when I first got here. I had good knees. I had, you know, I was in physical shape. And some senior class kids, Jimmy Smith Kramer was one of them. He took on a challenge. He wanted to play against me, and we dunked on each other every day on the short courts, and we just battled. Me and Jimmy go back quite a ways.
Jimmy's sophomore year, the Tohola Chitwins made it to state, and the tribe paid for charter buses to bring everyone who wanted to attend the game all the way across Washington to watch. So the bleachers were full of Tohola fans, including Corey. The Chitwins were down.
They're running out of time, and Jimmy grabbed it. You know, he's beyond half court. You know, he threw it up 80 feet, probably 70 feet. Yeah!
The Chitwins lost the game by 1 point, but
when he hit that shot, there was a lot of elders there, and a lot of them were in tears.
Everything he did, he was good at.
Mike Rose was the Chitwins' head basketball coach when Jimmy was in high school.
He was in the spotlight all the time. All the kids knew him. Everybody knew him. The fact that he was so good made his presence more noticeable.
After Jimmy graduated from high school, he got work as a commercial fisherman. He and his girlfriend had twins, a boy and a girl. He was trying to get into community college and onto a basketball team. In the meantime, he and his best friend kept showing up at the high school to help coach.
Run their drills and push them. I mean, they would come and they would push the kids. Say, now this is how you do it. You know, you go hard on every drill, or this is, you know, how you play defense. But they were also there to play because they just loved to play. They just loved to play the game.
Coaching high school students wasn't the only way Jimmy gave back to the community. He had a reputation as a good hunter. He'd give away the deer and the elk he shot to elders and others who needed the meat. Taking care of others was what he did the night of his 20th birthday, too. When the argument began between Jimmy's friend Harvey and the two men in the pickup truck, Jimmy wasn't involved. It wasn't until that pickup truck was headed toward Harvey that Jimmy rushed over to try to save his friend.
You know, when he tackled Harvey, he took a blunt force. He saved Harvey's life.
Jimmy was on life support when his uncle Corey got to the hospital.
He was gone, but he wasn't gone. He still had a heartbeat. So I stayed with him, rub his feet, rub his legs. Something I did for him, you know, growing up playing basketball, football, baseball, track, whatever sport he was doing. I always rubbed his legs and rubbed his feet after games because he would cramp really bad. You know, when he's laying in that hospital bed, I kept watching his heart monitor. I would rub his feet, you know, hoping there's something. And there was nothing. And some of the hardest times in my life was, you know, sitting there watching my boy, you know, die.
Corey made the decision to take Jimmy off life support and donate his organs. Jimmy's friend Harvey lived. The news reached Coach Mike Rose the next day.
And it was shocking when I heard. I mean, I remember I was just so depressed because I just, you know, seen him not that long ago. It was just seemed like it was just the other day that he'd been with our practice and everything, and now he was gone. It was such an emptiness that, you know, just couldn't be filled again.
Law enforcement originally charged the man who ran over Jimmy with murder, but they downgraded the charge to manslaughter. In the end, he was sentenced to 7.5 years. People on the reservation are still upset about that. They see what happened as murder and a hate crime. I saw Justice for Jimmy bumper stickers as I drove around the reservation.
And what if things were reversed? What if these Indian kids, you know, ran over this white man? How would things be settled in court?
The Tohola community didn't get closure in the courtroom, so they had to say goodbye in their own way, on the basketball court. Last season, the high school team wore Jimmy's number 5 on their shoulders all season. As for the number 5 jersey itself, Tyler Crossgun says the players were always fighting over it.
They would see number 5 and they would say, oh, I want to be Jimmy, I want to be Jimmy, and they would grab that jersey.
But the players can't fight over that jersey anymore, because at the end of last season, the school retired it.
The gym was so packed, it was crazy. There wasn't even place to sit down. There was people standing along the walls. There was people packed in the doors. It was a full game. They did all say their goodbyes, and they knew that his heart was still there.
And even though kids on the Quinault Reservation can no longer wear the number 5 jersey, they still want to be like Jimmy. Corey's 6-year-old son calls him brother.
He just sits there and plays and plays and plays. You know, he all asked me, is this how my brother shot? Did he shoot baskets like this, Dad? You know, stuff like that all the time.
That story was brought to us by reporter Eilish O'Neill. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. I'm J.A. Adande. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.